So it is such a pleasure for my latest nostalgia interview to meet Becky Jeffcoat, and we are here on a beautiful sunny afternoon at the end of May in London at the Royal Society for Arts.
And in fact we're going on later on today to the annual London branch Lampeter dinner reunion, is that right?
Yeah, and I get the sense you've been to more of those than I have.
I've actually been to two.
Same here then. Yeah. We, one of them we overlapped, and I think the other one, I think my first one was the one before lockdown, so 2019.
Right.
And yeah. We were at Lampeter together.
We were, yeah. Which was an amazing, yeah. Amazing experience. Yeah.
So you were 91 to 94 as well.
I was, yeah. I was indeed.
Yeah. And if I've got it right, you were, was it archaeology and English?
That's yeah. Right, archaeology yeah. And English literature. And actually, I kind of got there by default, through not doing as well as I'd hoped in my A-levels. So I actually got there through clearing, but was always very keen to do archaeology as one of the subjects. But when I was doing my A-levels, the head teacher there was pretty scary, pretty traditional, was very much wanting people to study. She used to say, you want to do single honours, you want to do a decent proper degree. And she didn't feel that archaeology was such a degree. So I was actually quite pleased in the end at how it worked out, to actually get to not do as well as I'd hoped my A-levels. And to end up in Lampeter through clearing, but doing the subject that I loved.
But that story, though, is, although everyone's story is unique, the number of people who have that same experience of, in some cases, never having heard of Lampeter, but then suddenly finding that not only did they thrive there, but ended up, in some cases, maybe even carrying on in an academic context and sort of like, I'm now a professor of blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But, you know, if it hadn't been for Lampeter, yeah. You know, I wouldn't have gone to university at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was definitely one of those places where you, when you arrived, it was so, so unique and so wonderful. You actually found out pretty quickly whether or not you fitted in. And actually, if it wasn't for you, you realised quite quickly. But actually, in terms of those people, I can only think of a couple of people who actually arrived and very quickly decided for different reasons they didn't want to stay.
But it's a funny place because I work in another university, obviously in Canterbury, and I love working there and I've been there for 20 years. But there was something about Lampeter where you kind of felt that as long as when you arrived, it had the right kind of vibe. You just knew that you were going to see out that period. It was interesting. It was almost as though, against the odds, because a lot of people who visited there, friends of mine who've gone there for conferences and they like, it was great for a weekend, but I managed 48 hours. How did you manage 10 years? And I think that's and I think you have to be of a certain kind of mindset. And if you are of that mindset, you'll have the best time ever.
Yeah.
And you'll come back, as we do, for reunions.
I completely agree. Yeah. And certainly, maybe that's partly why that group of people that we know who went to Lampeter have, on the most part, stayed in touch and stayed friends for all of these years afterwards. I think it definitely took a certain sort of person, perhaps people who are sort of quite self-sufficient. It was a very unique group of people. But also, I think the fact that everything was just all there on the campus, a whole community, made it a magical place, really.
And obviously now, through social media, through Facebook, it's so easy to keep in touch with friends. But for years, I used to wonder, before Facebook, you know, what's everyone doing? Who's, you know, what are all those wonderful people doing these days? Did you keep in touch with a lot of people during those, what I would call those lean years?
Those lean years. I suppose I kept in touch with a smaller group of friends, really, immediately after we graduated. And that was when I sort of left Lampeter, although I was living in Lincolnshire. I actually moved to London quite quickly after that and started working here in London. And at that time, probably stayed in touch with kind of a handful of close friends. But looking back, that was actually before Facebook, thinking about it. So it was probably only, oh, I don't know, maybe 10 years after that, through things like Facebook and sort of social media, I've actually reconnected with a much, much bigger group of people as well, which has been lovely.
And the thing that I found, and I guess that applies to us as well, is that we didn't know each other that well then, which is, you know, considering the size of the place, how could you not know every single person? Yet we know each other more now. And some of those people who were really close friends in those days perhaps are still there, but kind of more, slightly more periphery. So it kind of all balances out somehow. You sort of, I think, you find the right kind of level, you know, at whatever stage you are in your life. Yeah. And somehow those friendships become either more entrenched or in some cases, you know, you sort of build on them in some cases, which is a bit weird, 30 years after you first met people. It's like, wow. But that kind of says a lot about Lampeter as well.
Doesn't it? And what an amazing thing to have in common. And also I found that even sort of after being there and living there, you know, for those, I was there for 3 years. I did my first degree and I stayed on to do a sort of a management course directly afterwards. But even in kind of years after that, when I bumped into people who I didn't know personally at Lampeter and were either there, you know, before me or afterwards, if we find they've got that in common, it instantly becomes a real bond. So I was actually working on a heritage project in Suffolk recently, and the archaeologist there said to me, oh, you know, this reminds me of my days at Lampeter. And instantly it was like, oh, yeah. Lampeter!
And were you contemporaries at Lampeter?
No, I think she was there in the 80s.
No, I found that. In fact, a colleague who I work with at Kent, who has quite a senior sort of role but does timetabling and exams, she was at Lampeter same year as us, but never knew her. And it's funny, just and that happens quite a bit. And I think she might have done archaeology as well, maybe Swedish. And it's so bizarre that suddenly you're like, hang on, but what is so odd is that even if you didn't know each other then, the friendship immediately hits off because you've got so much in common and there's always going to be some mutual friend or other. That kind of, I wonder, because I've done more interviews with Lampeter people than those who've been elsewhere.
Yes.
But I do wonder if that applies anywhere else to the same degree. And I suspect it doesn't.
Yeah, I agree. I think it really was a very special place.
Yeah.
I feel so lucky that I ended up there almost by accident.
Yeah. But it's the best way sometimes, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How much of life is predetermined and how much of it is random?
And I've personally never been someone who has had that kind of life plan. I've had friends and, like, my sister in particular always had her plan as to what she wanted to do and where she wanted to be. I think it's useful in some ways, but I've just never been like that.
Yeah. But did that work for her?
It did.
Yeah, okay.
It did. Very focused, whereas I've kind of almost taken the long route round sometimes.
Because the other thing that I'm so fascinated by, and the reason I was so keen to do an interview with you as well, was the work that you do, which I know caters or it deals with nostalgia, and it's, was it the Cartoon Museum? Do you want to say a bit about that? Because there's a whole thing around Norwich as well, I think.
Yes.
Which we have in common, because I went there, took my children, saw the circus and so on, and you gave me this amazing advice about the places to go on holiday. So do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So sort of nostalgia and heritage. Yeah, so I used to work at the Cartoon Museum here in London, and that was kind of following a period where I worked in various kind of arts organisations, mostly kind of on the marketing side, really. So I worked in a theatre, worked in a gallery, worked at the Opera House in Covent Garden, then moved to Norfolk, and then actually came back to London for work for the Cartoon Museum. And the Cartoon Museum itself has a collection which is very much based on, I suppose, the original traditional cartoons, so by people like Hogarth and that kind of thing. So when I took over at the Cartoon Museum, it was my job to try and look at the collection, look at the museum itself, and try and make it more relevant and more entertaining. So a lot of the work I did there was about exploring with different audiences, you know, what was the relevance of cartoons to them personally. And it was fascinating talking to people from different backgrounds and different ages in particular as to what their own personal favourite cartoons actually were. Because, of course, it ranged from everything from the really traditional cartoons like the Hogarths through to, I suppose, what I would think of as cartoons. So basically telly cartoons in the 1980s, in the 1970s, things like Bagpuss, Jamie and the Magic Torch. And then moving on to people who are younger than me, basically graphic novels and sort of stop frame animation and sort of modern films and modern interpretations of cartoon. And we ended up actually having an exhibition which was specifically called Nostalgia, and very much looked into that, you know, why were these particular cartoons important to people? And mostly it was that the cartoon itself, whatever it was, reminded them of a certain time in their lives. It was usually a time that was comforting, that was happy. It was a lovely thing to do.
Yeah.
So, a really interesting experience.
And did you find that people's experiences from then were they magically sort of taken back? Because you mentioned Bagpuss and so on. Because that was, I think, there were quite a few generations even before us. Because, that was like a staple of TV. Because when you're 4 or 5 years of age, you don't know that, you know, the concept of that's been here for 10 years means absolutely nothing. But it's the number of generations for whom that is their childhood identity is so precious. And it's like, what do you do with that? And I find that as well sometimes when you have people, we've had some of them in the news this week, where maybe they're part of your sort of background association.
Yes,
but then
yes,
cartoon so obviously comes in there.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, what do you do with that? Because then you get into the territory of something where nostalgia doesn't seem the right word, but you're almost like, you know, how do you mentally adjust to something that actually doesn't really kind of fit with the way you want that childhood to be remembered?
Yes.
So have you come across a lot of those sort of the good and the bad ways of
definitely
what nostalgia kind of is, that bitter and
absolutely,
the sweet?
Absolutely. So I can think of examples where I can think of two people who were a bit older than me, probably same age as my parents really, who were describing their own favourite cartoon and sort of TV programmes from when they were young. And it was things like Muffin the Mule and Bill and Ben, that kind of thing. And from kind of starting off remembering that experience of watching that on the telly, they started to remember other things. It was all related to their own families, to what they were having for tea. And then one lady got very upset because then she sort of remembered watching telly and then her dad hitting her kind of after that. And all of a sudden, you could see watching her that memory was raw and was real. So, I mean, I think in some ways it's very therapeutic to kind of bring it up and talk about it and to remember it and to reflect on it. But I agree, it's what you do with that information.
Yeah, and I found, because I don't know if you've ever kept a diary, but that's something which I've done. And actually, it's a lovely corrective because it kind of, it does, you know, you don't need the diary to sort of reminisce, but having the diary gives you a sense of almost a corroboration that although maybe a lot of things you've misremembered, and maybe some of the things that, you know, maybe some important events you didn't even record in the first place, or because maybe at the time you just sort of, the thing that you quickly jot down in the day was not the thing that you remember 10 years on. But also, I think it is wonderfully therapeutic, because if you have that juxtaposition of the good and the not so good, well, it's kind of there, it's going to come out in some capacity anyway. So it kind of, but you have to be in the right zone for that.
Yes.
But I'm guessing that watching some of those programs, probably as you said with the lady who you encountered there, that must have been really quite difficult to process. And you never know quite what you're opening up.
Exactly. And I remember her saying to me, oh, it's just so good to tell my story. It's good to remember and to be able to talk about it. So I suppose in that respect, it's very kind of therapeutic. But in that particular example, we were actually recording people's memories and using them as part of the display, part of the exhibition. So then we almost had to go through that curatorial process of going, how much of this do we want to kind of put on public display, and how much do we want to keep private for that person that's shared their story with us? Really interesting.
I often find in those situations, because I've been interviewed by people, and they sort of say, don't worry, I won't use your real name. And I'm thinking, but actually I think you have to use my real name, because if I'm going to be divulging something which is very personal and bespoke to me, then it seems a bit odd then to have that very personal, very specific experience, but then to use an alternative name, because then you're almost sort of taking away that kind of authenticity and sort of like having an authentic narrative, but changing the person who had it, which actually is almost like to take away somebody's, you know, selfhood.
Yes, I agree. And I think also when you're looking at a situation where you're kind of adding a story to a bigger group of stories, so whether that's kind of contemporary stories and memories, or whether it's adding your own story to something that happened in the past, you know, it's important that your name is there, is associated to it.
And you nodded vigorously when I asked about the diary. So is that something that you've always had?
No, I had a diary when I was at school, and then I actually had a diary when I was at Lampeter. And I've still got it. In fact, I've got three, one for each of the sort of main years I was there. Yeah. And in my parents' house at home in Lincolnshire, they've got boxes of kind of stuff from those years. It really is like the Museum of Beck. So it's kind of yearbooks, it's photos, it's postcards, it's even things like notes that we would write to each other on our doors, and drawings and other silly things, but also the diaries. Yeah. It's quite interesting reading them back, how reading them now, there are things in the diary that I had completely forgotten. But then there are other things that are kind of, I suppose, to me, very much in sharp focus. In fact, I was there about 6 months ago, kind of going through these boxes and, you know, trying to part with things and failing miserably, but read some of the diaries. That's really funny, actually, just kind of looking back at some of the memories. And how vividly I can remember some of those now, even though it's over 30 years.
Well, something that I did, because I didn't used to write anything like as much in those days as I do now. But what I did, and I'm glad I did it, because if I'd attempted this now, I would have remembered even less than I did then. But I annotated the diaries. So I digitised them all. So I wrote them all up. I mean, that took a few years, as you'd imagine. It was like 1 a.m. But what I did was to, using italics, so it was clearly, you know, not me trying to rewrite the past, because that, for me, that you know, that would be to profane the sacred. So what I did was to put down my reflection on, you know, this is what I think happened, ... or I was augmenting memories. And in some cases I might do that, then find a few entries later that actually that was when the thing that I thought might have happened. So I might make an adjustment to the annotation. But what I was trying to do is ensure that I was kind of trying to maybe in some ways make peace with that period, or trying to sort of do justice to the people who at that point I was not in touch with. Because the only access I had to them in a way was through the diary, because some of those people I went to university with are not on social media.
No.
And I, in some cases, I have no idea what's happened to them. So in a way, I almost felt that the only thing I have, apart from photographs, obviously, from that era, is a diary record, which of course is very bespoke to me, and it's obviously not something that anybody else yet has read. So in that sense, it was a very interesting thing about what you do, because you've got this sort of strange control over something that happened 30 years ago in terms of the way that you're bringing out, in some cases quite confidential, I suppose, but, you know, very personal narratives.
Are you planning to share the diary at some point, or is it very much for you?
I definitely want to disseminate it in some way, but in a way that is respectful. So in other words, I feel I should, but in a way that in some cases it might be that some of those names would have to be changed. But at the same time, it feels that it would be odd to have all those millions of words and kind of not do anything with it. But whether that's something for, you know, after I've gone, or whether I kind of want to be there to witness it in some way.
Yes.
And I definitely would rather the latter. I want to be in control. You know, I want to see people's reactions, but not in a way that's anything bad in there. This is, you know, the diary is not a sort of recrimination. It's not a way of almost trying to sort of, you know, say, you know, revenge for what happened in a Count of Monte Cristo style. Although in some cases there are things that perhaps I want to try and understand that I've never understood, and trying to work out particular journeys that didn't go in the way that you expected or hoped. So there is something cathartic about sharing that, because you know that it kind of, there are other people who might be able to take up the narrative and do what it's impossible for you to do by yourself.
I agree, especially if you're the sort of person who tends to be more naturally looking back and kind of reflecting on things that have happened, rather than perhaps more naturally living here in the now, or very much just focused on whatever's happening next. I think if you are someone who almost has a tendency to be looking back and pondering and mulling over what happened, it's really useful to have that there.
And tell me a bit about, so growing up, because am I right in thinking that you're from the sort of Norwich area, is that right? Is that your background?
Well, I actually was born in Birkenhead on the Wirral, but when I was really small, my parents moved to Lincolnshire over on the east coast. So my mum and dad bought an old farmhouse and a small holding. So my childhood was very much lots of animals. Yeah. It's kind of growing up in the country, lots of goats, pigs and sheep and lovely dogs and cats and rabbits and all sorts
of things. I can see why Lampeter appealed.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. But actually where I grew up there in Lincolnshire is probably only about an hour and a half from where we actually live now in Norfolk, the North Norfolk coast. So my parents still live in Lincolnshire in the same house, so it's quite nice to be that close to them sort of geographically.
Yeah. And what about, so growing up, so we've covered all the diaries and stuff, but obviously you have a great interest, and I'm sure we'll get onto the circus connection, because you so recommended that my children loved it, the circus
they?
In the absolutely in Norwich.
Oh, that's amazing.
But what about, obviously you did English, so I'm guessing the literature had a big role growing up. Films, books, what music, what were the sort of go-to
things for Becky
growing up?
Oh my goodness, well, let me think. I suppose one of my favourite things when I was really quite young, probably only about 11, was, this bit embarrassing. Robin of Sherwood, yeah. Which was a
TV show. Was that Jason Connery?
Yes, Jason Connery,
yes.
And Michael Praed.
Yeah.
I was a huge fan. I can't remember what date that would have come out in, 1986
sort of period.
Something like
be,
that, yeah.
It was like Saturday afternoon. Something like 20 past 5. I don't know why that's come out. It was obviously in those days, you see, we had to watch things when they came out. We didn't have VCRs.
Yes, no,
so the times have sort of been embedded in my thought you know, that's what we did on a Saturday afternoon.
That's so true.
Evening.
And then if you missed it, you had to sort of catch up with friends at school and what happened.
Yeah.
And I just remember it being very sort of very romantic, but also very sort of exciting, very adventurous. Mm. And that programme had a real background of kind of mystical wild England that really appealed to me. Then when I was a bit older, my favourite film, which is actually still my favourite film, came out.
You're saying Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Indiana Jones.
Of course.
And Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. And in fact, it's quite funny that I loved the film instantly, but that actually had a huge impact on me personally in terms of what I decided to do as a career. And decided to do archaeology, although it's quite funny that I thought that my experience of archaeology was going to be like his experience. Very different. Yeah.
But I've got a friend, a female friend, who was at Kent a few years ago, interviewed her some years ago, and she always brings up Indiana Jones because she herself does a lot of globetrotting, and she's somebody who would always arrive on the first day of term. Literally, she'd arrive at, like, imagine there was a meeting with the new students at 2 in the afternoon. I'm not joking. On the dot of 2 o'clock, she'd arrive with her suitcase and literally had all the, you know, you could tell she'd just come from the airport, had all the labels attached to it.
Wow.
And she literally, and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm a bit, you know, a bit late." And she'd come from some like war-torn country in West Africa, or she'd go to Thailand or somewhere, but, you know, not the obvious sort of destinations.
Yeah.
She'd go to
the
sort of places, and she said to herself, "Do you know, I had an argument with the security people at the airport, and actually they nearly didn't let me leave, sort of thing. But here I am, and so yeah, let me talk about the modules that were running this term." And you're like, So it sounds very similar.
Yes.
Of that sort of needing something a little bit exotic, a little bit different.
Yeah.
And really building on that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And wanting to understand people that have come before me and their stories. So that really did inspire me. And that was the reason that I started thinking, could I do that? Could I do that as a job? Is that an option? And then, I suppose, around the same time, maybe a little bit later, music at the time, I guess for us, was very much kind of electro-pop type music. Pet Shop Boys was my absolute favourite. And again, actually has remained my favourite for all of these years since.
Yeah. Is that the thing, though? Because I find that it's quality-proof. I listen to things like Pick Up the Pops, and that is my childhood. And my children might say things like, "God, this is awful," and I'm like, "But it's in my DNA.
Yeah.
I can't distinguish. You know, the quality of the stuff is irrelevant. The things I grew up with, that, and it's so core to who I am. And every time I hear those tunes, I remember what I did in school, the friends I was playing with, and it's so interesting how that carries with you all these decades on. And I haven't taken on new music. Films, I watch all the new releases, but music for me is very much stuck in the 80s. Is that similar for you?
Very similar. Definitely some of my favourites were my favourite then and still are. I mean, I suppose a bit later for me, at Lampeter in particular, Crowded House was a big favourite, and I was really lucky in that I saw them live twice last year. Yeah. Just magical, just absolutely magical. But like you, it's hearing those songs today, and almost part of me is back there, is experiencing them and all of the memories that kind of go with the music. Gorgeous, what a powerful thing.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned Crowded House,
yeah,
because I think one of my very recent interviewees, Susan, was talking about that, and I heard Crowded House on the radio yesterday, the Weather With You song, and this is interesting because that was more sort of early 90s, 93 kind of period,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I wasn't quite in that sort of zone, but because it's been referenced, as it has now by you, and I've got lots of other friends who talk about Crowded House, so it's almost as though I'm wallowing in their nostalgia, because I think, okay, I wasn't listening to that in 93, but I was very much around in 93. So when I hear that, it sort of has an interesting recalibration, if that makes sense, because it's making me think, okay, I associate that now with certain people.
Yes.
And I'm like, okay, so I sort of moved away from the chart scene by that point.
Yeah.
But that is now a song I always associate with Lampeter Friends. And now you've just added to that roster.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And whilst we were at Lampeter, I was one of the the DJs, you know, they had the union discos on a, I think, a Wednesday and a Friday and a Saturday night with Susan, who were the sort of the duo of DJs. But it's interesting because at the time, yeah, that was 91 to 94, but a lot of the music we were playing was actually 80s music. Yeah. From our own childhood a few years before. And those songs take me back in exactly the same way.
Well, you would have been a far more accomplished professional DJ than I was. At the Union Bar. Maybe I had a radio DJ, I could probably do, but I'm not sure doing that on the floor. But I did have a go a few times at recent reunions in Lampeter. And that was really funny because it was like that chance to suddenly like, okay, I can now play all my favourite songs, and then seeing
the power.
I got the power. But interestingly, that sometimes people got up and sometimes they didn't, and it's just interesting. You're like, this one hasn't connected, but it's always the stuff that did. And once you'd think, okay, they're not dancing to this. Let's try Shaking Stevens. They all get up, and you're like, now that's interesting because I was once, and this would have been after the time that we were undergraduates. I know I'm not making this up, but it's almost like, but this sounds so unbelievable. I was there, maybe they were just testing the sound system once, my recollection, it was like an early evening or sort of around 6, 7pm, and it was in the Union Hall, and they were so probably around 97, 98, and somebody put on Magic Moments, you know, Perry Como, and it was like, this is not something that people will be dancing to. But, you know, that's not the sort of music that was ever played. And people were like, what is this stuff? And they all got up, and everyone was doing it in a sort of like naff kind of way. But it got everyone up. And then when they said, like, normality was resumed and started playing all the sort of the 80s house music or whatever, people were like, oh, okay. And they all sat down again. And I thought, you could never, you know, there's no way anyone is then going to say, okay, let's have an evening of 50s classics. Yeah. But what is interesting is that something clicked. All those years later, my children do stuff like their nursery or school, and one of those Perry Como songs, it might have been The Catch a Falling Star, they were performing, and that song came on the radio or whatever, and they were like, why are you listening to that on the radio? That's our nursery song. And it's so interesting, because suddenly cross-generational appeal. And so I kind of get that, but it's not the sort of thing that sort of fits. It's like when John Lennon died. But then he had two number ones retrospectively, and then St Winifred's School Choir. You know, there's no one quite like Grandma. It doesn't quite fit, but somehow it all kind of is bespoke to that era.
Yes.
It doesn't fit any sort of obvious narrative.
No.
And that's what music does.
Doesn't it? Yeah. And then how so much of it now is almost being remixed and recut and reused in a different way.
Yeah.
So there are elements of those songs that you hear now are the ones that bring the nostalgia, but it's not the whole song.
But isn't that true with the Pet Shop Boys though? Because they sort of do a lot of new music, but they also really, and they're very sensible in that sense, that they know that they have to play all the earlier stuff because that is what brought the audience there. But they're still making lots of new, very creative stuff. So how do you feel? So if you go to a gig, whether it's Crowded House or I don't know if you've seen the Pet Shop Boys.
I have, yes.
Do you get excited about new stuff, or is it when they play West End Girls it's a sin?
Oh, I suppose it's both, because I've been a sort of lifelong fan. I suppose it's the older stuff that I would be sad if they didn't play, but I think they're particularly good at kind of rolling out all of the hits as well as the new stuff, whereas I think some bands, when you see them live, they're more focused on, okay, this is a particular tour around a particular album, and it's kind of the more recent stuff. And it's a shame not to have the old ones as well.
Yeah, and obviously, so you did archaeology in English, which is kind of interesting because that Lampeter was great in that respect, that you could do sort of subjects that didn't obviously intersect, or you know, might be one is more perhaps more scientific, or certainly is more hands-on. The other one is literary. How did you find that balance? And did either or both of those help you in the career that you then followed?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think actually it was a really lovely balance because although, you know, they are quite different, they also have that connection of being about people and people's stories, although archaeology is more about the sort of what people kind of left behind, the kind of, the, you know, the material culture. And then English was about what people had kind of written and expressed. So to bring those both together was really fantastic, actually. I absolutely loved it. I'm so pleased I chose that mix.
Yeah.
And they both really helped me. Because I suppose in English, we actually studied quite a lot of plays as well as kind of novels and poems. And so when I left Lampeter, I was very much focused on trying to get work in either the sort of the arts, kind of performing arts, really, or museum world with the archaeology, and I'm really lucky in that I ended up doing both, which from a career point of view was also really quite complementary.
And I think, and I always say that to my students as well, that sometimes if you can find the right mix for you, then don't worry that it might sound to somebody else like an odd combination, because you can do something with that combination that makes you... It's like people who've got... A lot of people who work in media or have tried to work in media have got a media studies degree, and that's the obvious route, and that's amazing. But if you've got somebody who's got, like, or religious studies or a sort of background, they might have to do, like, a law conversion course, but often when they move into their sort of chosen career, their background, which is not the obvious one, means that they sort of stand out from everyone else, and they can do things that perhaps no one else would want to do or could do in terms of, you know, if you're going into law or something, I suppose you're dealing with different religious groups and so on, can actually be an area of focus. But it sounds like that you managed that. But was that always the plan? So did you ever imagine that you'd end up working, for example, in the Cartoon Museum, but was that ever sort of the hope or the expectation, or did that just sort of randomly fall into place post Lampeter?
It did quite randomly fall into place, and I think I was really lucky in that I sort of, after I did my main degree, I did this business studies course, which is very focused on marketing and sort of understanding audiences. I did work experience at a place called the Oxford Story in Oxford, which was a bit like, well, it was owned by the same company that does Jorvik, so a kind of an immersive sort of visitor attraction, history adventure type thing. I really enjoyed that, but that was the marketing department. And then I just kind of, I went crazy after that and blitzed every arts organisation and museum I could think of. And at that time I was actually living back in Lincolnshire with my mum and dad. And really felt I needed a big change at that point in my life and needed to move to be somewhere where there was more life, different people, more excitement. And I was very focused on moving down here. And so I must have written probably 500-600 letters to every theatre, every museum, and ended up being really lucky and being interviewed and getting a job at the Opera House in Covent Garden as their marketing assistant initially, which was a lovely experience because it was just wonderful to be in that old theatre before they actually renovated it recently. So all of the backstage sort of equipment was made out of wood. They had the most amazing parties at Christmas. Each department had a themed party. So opera wigs would have one party, ballet shoes would have another. And it was just, it was a wonderful experience. And I met some lovely, amazing, quirky, interesting people.
Did you have the gate crash all of them?
I did.
Which party was most riotous?
To go to all of them. Yeah, and then I, from there, slowly did more marketing and audience development type work. Worked in a gallery, worked at the Bloomsbury Theatre, and then eventually actually moved to work at the Museum of London, which was, I think it still is, probably one of my favourite jobs, really. And at that point, I was in charge of audience development and marketing for the museum, but was working really closely with the design team on the creation of the exhibitions and the sort of the interpretation. At that point in my life, I actually moved to Norfolk and worked on a project there, which was a redevelopment project of a former Maltings building, including a heritage centre and a theatre. And then actually when I left that job, when the project was complete, that was when I actually got the job at the Cartoon Museum. So it was, I think, a combination, really, of luck and persistence and just being in the right place at the right time as well.
And I'm guessing that you found that sounds such an amazing journey, because I'm guessing as well that, as well as sort of listening to other people's nostalgic, you know, reminiscences, that you're acquiring your own along the way, as we all do in life. So,
absolutely.
I'm guessing that you sort of do, and that's what I found through these interviews, is that you're dealing with other people's reminiscences, other people's nostalgias, but it's going to intersect with your own and actually make you sort of thinking, gosh, that was part of my childhood as well, but let me look at that in a bit more detail, because that person has made me realise that that's something that I should return to.
That's so true, actually, just meeting lots of people, getting them to share their stories. And I think even more recently than that, particularly during COVID lockdown, at that point I was working as a sort of museums consultant, where a lot of museums were having to really think about what they did and how they connected with people, and how they encouraged people to kind of use their space in a different way and share their own stories. So kind of connecting people, bringing them together, bringing people into kind of museum spaces and being inspired by their collections and their stories. Yeah.
Are there any ones that really stand out? I mean, you've mentioned one already, but with the sort of, you know, the bag person and so on. But was there anybody who sort of like maybe went in not expecting to suddenly have this whole past evoked? You know, was there any particular memories that you sort of that really stayed with you from the time that people would come in and share their testimonies?
Oh yes, lots of amazing stories, really. And surprising stories. So, for example, I was quite recently doing a project at, the Royal Hospital Chelsea, where they have the Chelsea pensioners. And part of my job there was to interview the people who live on site, the Chelsea pensioners, and kind of record some of their stories and their memories. And one man there was telling me about how he, you know, he lives today with his red jacket in the Chelsea pensioners kind of barracks area. He does lots of art, and he's very happy, but he talks about the life before he came there, where he used to be a champion archery expert and had won kind of Olympic medals, but then ended up in a situation where his marriage broke down. I think he had a problem with drugs and with alcohol, and his life was really challenging, and he ended up having a bit of a breakdown and actually leaving his sort of normal, straightforward life, you could say, and living in Wales in the middle of nowhere, and basically just kind of world camping for a year. And he said he dug a hole in the ground, you know, he camped there, he fished for his own food, and his family didn't know where they were looking for him, and they only realised where he was because the police had seen the smoke from his campfire. Amazing.
Oh,
just amazing, and just sort of really, really unexpected, you know. But being able to kind of work with someone and say, okay, what are your memories? Let's go back. What were the important parts of your life? What are your regrets? What are you most proud of? These sorts of questions. It was amazing what came out.
And were you recording these on cassette? And what format? Or were these digitally done?
Yeah, digitally done with a view to actually presenting them as part of an exhibition that kind of shows people perhaps, you know, what lies behind the facade, if you like.
I suppose that's a perfect moment for me to ask you as we start to wrap up. But that whole question about, as you look back on your life, you know, do you find that your memories are generally positive ones?
Yes, I do. I think on the whole, they are positive ones. I don't know whether the passing of time helps with that, whether you tend to almost remember the good bits the best. But yes.
And I ask that because that's always my follow-up question, which is about whether you can be nostalgic about, you know, negative experiences, because I suppose the fact we're doing this podcast now, in my case, it was like, oh, you know, I'm doing it because, you know, I wasn't doing it 5 years, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's probably trying to work out particular sort of narratives, particular sort of trying to understand people better, trying to understand myself better, I suppose, through that.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's the things that don't make sense are the things that somehow you sort of look back and say, okay, but if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
So and it's an odd thing because we don't go through negative experiences sometimes thinking, oh, but in 5 years' time I'm going to claim this as a positive. But often, and I don't know whether that's an innate thing about survival, but the way that sometimes we reclaim the past, maybe it's a coping mechanism, maybe it's a form of therapy, but it's how we engage with the past, but in a way that sometimes ensures that we find a spin on it that we can justify to ourselves as a way of saying, you know, this happened, I survived, I'm here.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's having the past experiences and be able to take comfort from them in a lot of circumstances. I think it's also that thing about, you know, you do live and you learn. So I think often you can look back on experiences in your life that were awful, that were negative, that were heartbreaking, and you can definitely learn things from that about yourself and how you were in that situation and how it's relevant to how you live your life today.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, and that whole question, I always think of like the Shawshank Redemption at this point. The whole like, what does your younger self, or what conversation would your younger self have with you now, or what conversation, what dialogue would there be between your present self and your younger self? Like, what did you expect that you'd end up doing when you were younger? You mentioned Indiana Jones, but you know, what did you kind of? Would your younger self be surprised about what you've ended up doing now?
I think so, yes. I think so. Because I remember thinking at the time, I'd love to do archaeology, but you know, can we even do that? Is there a course on that?
Mm.
Is that a real job or not? But I think me talking to my younger self would be very much, you know, go for it, you know, aim high and do what really makes you happy, you know, do what brings you joy.
Yeah, and part of all of that, you know, I mean, I think about the time that I was at university, and I suppose I was there because I was at Lampeter for 10 years, and, yeah. you know, I voted for the first time when I was at Lampeter. All those sort of rites of passage.
Yeah,
and there are things that I clearly would do the same thing again now, and I suppose maybe I'd look back and think, oh, well, maybe that was naive, or I wouldn't have done that if I'd known what I know now, kind of thing. But do you have any of those sort of memories as well? So are there things that you did at Lampeter? It might be, in my case, I was always this big like, radio obsessive, and I guess I still am. But do you have any of those sort of things, whether it was sport or whether it was music or radio or anything, that was sort of like something that you learnt at Lampeter, something at the university particularly, that you've taken with you in the years since?
Yes. I mean, for me, it was probably, I was in the drama society at Lampeter, and I just loved it. I loved it. We did.
I probably saw performances that you did.
Dr. Faustus, yeah. Midsummer Night's Dream, mm. for one night only, in the old building. And yeah. I absolutely loved it.
Do you
I love the friends I made, the people yeah. I met, and the experience I had in that respect.
It's funny you said one night only.
Yeah.
I bet you have stronger memories of that evening when it was one night only than another performance they might have done yeah. every night for a week.
Absolutely. I can remember vividly, you know, what everybody was wearing, what the costumes were, what some of the lines were. Mm. It's yeah. strange, isn't it? But that's something I've taken with yeah. me. So I've kind of, through the years, I've been in different drama groups yeah. and kind of performed yeah. and always kind of loved that. Yeah.
Memories are very odd because I found that I've done things sometimes, like maybe like a walk to work or a drive. You do it every single day. You'd think that you'd have like this amazing, you know every single, if something's different, you notice it, but sometimes you're like, something feels different today, but I can't work out what it is. But I found that I've done things like the same walk for year after year. And then you find that maybe after 10 years, you suddenly go back and you think, oh, it feels same but different. It's like,
yes.
it has a familiarity, but I sort of don't,
yes.
it feels odd.
Yeah.
But there are some things that you've done once in your life, but you have very firm, very clear memories of those. And yet it's those unrepeatable experiences
yes.
that somehow are more enduring. And it's yeah. a paradox. I've never quite worked out what it is. Because sometimes I've been in rooms like where I'm living and somebody might have taken a bookcase out, and then they say, oh, where did the bookcase go exactly? And I'm like, I don't know, I don't even know which way it was facing. And yet I will immediately pick up on things from 30 years ago,
yes.
you know, very, very clear memories of
yes.
location of objects or of people or conversations, which were unique to that period. So there's something in our psyche that somehow allows us sometimes to sort of almost remember the things that are unforgettable, and the things that are a bit more prosaic and everyday, kind of, we somehow let that slide.
It's strange, isn't it? What is that?
Yeah.
Is it that there are just certain memories that are just imprinted?
Yeah.
Because I agree, I feel the same. And I think some memories like that are very, very sensory. So it's like we've talked about the music, but also it can be a smell.
Yeah.
It can be what the weather was like or what the temperature was like.
Yeah.
And you can almost, you can imagine exactly what it felt like, certain experiences.
Yeah. And I do it with years, because I remember 93 is one example. I associate that year with a lot of sunshine. And I'm sure, I mean, I know there was snow at the beginning of that year, but it's funny how sometimes there are particular years and you think, that was a good year, the sun was shining kind of thing. And the other years you think, oh, that was a bit of a bleak year, or oh, that was a very rainy, a very wet year. But it's
yeah.
funny how, but it's things like that, that sometimes the weather, this is about a crowded house, but sometimes the associations
yes.
are,
yes.
It's, or they're both composite, because of course, you know, it was never going to be sunny every single day, and yet the association with certain years sometimes is actually that was a good period. Everything was kind of working in balance, and those good days somehow dwarf those other
yeah.
more inclement days.
Yeah.
Is that your experience?
Absolutely, in every way, in
yeah.
a sort of an actual way, but also a sort
yeah.
of emotional way
yeah, yeah.
as well. But interesting, you mentioned that year, because that makes me think. Mm. Yeah, I remember that year as the year where we had lots of kind of picnics in the sunshine by the river at Lampeter.
Yeah.
So. It was just a really good year.
I do think as well that these days, of course, you know, we continue often the same kind of conversations, albeit
yeah.
as now middle-aged people that, you know,
yeah.
we were when we were younger.
Yeah.
But in a funny way, there is that sense that people don't change, and I don't want them to change. Because if you suddenly find 30 years on, you think, oh, you were a good friend of mine 30 years ago, and now I don't recognise you at all. You've been a bit betrayed, or you suddenly feel, oh, I invested all the, you know, emotions in somebody and all these attachments, and then suddenly they're like, well, they're not somebody I would particularly want to know. But that I find really interesting, that sometimes people make an impression. But if they make an impression, even if you haven't seen them for 30 years, even if you don't know what they've been doing in the meantime, you just pick up.
That's so true. And I'm pleased that that's the way it is. Yeah. Because I guess there's the part on the outside that gets older that does change a little bit. And I guess there's the experiences that you have along the way that you take with you, that you learn from, that do affect you in some ways. But I think the heart, the part inside is still the same.
Yeah. And I got one more question for you, Becky, which is the question I ask everyone. But,
of course.
You know what it is, but are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, amazing question. I think I have a tendency to be a looking back person because I would say I'm a extremely nostalgic person myself. But I do try to be a person that is getting better at living in the here and the now. I think in my own life, I feel the winds of change, and I'm getting more excited about the future because I think there are sort of changes afoot. But I think I try to be somebody who is focusing on the here and now, because I think that's all you ever have, really. It's this moment and making the most of it.
Yeah. What a perfect, very upbeat answer as we descend on all our friends from 30 years ago.
We can ask them the same question, can't we?
I will see do it. Yeah. I'll do a live nostalgia interview with the whole group.
You should, I think you should.
Becky, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I've loved it.